I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is a Roifield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
I'm enamored with America for many reasons, and one of them is the ability to go into a space, into a bar or a restaurant, and talk to the person next to you and discover the extraordinary path that their life is on. As a stranger to this country, it's one of the many upsides was to be able to walk into a bar, sit at a seat, and have a conversation, if not just with the barman, but with a person to the left or to the right of me. And that's what I did some months ago, and met a rather extraordinary woman who had an incredibly atypical story, a story of two found loves, one for an ancient but also modern religion, but also for the country of which that religion came from, whilst practicing law and trying to right social wrongs. Here is my conversation with Nicole Phillips. Nicole, how predetermined is anyone's life? If someone can be born in the Bay Area and end up being a human rights lawyer, what are the pivot points of your life which has led you to not only to Haiti but also to marry in five Haitian spirits?
Well, I think probably in my case, I can't speak for others, but in my case, love had a lot to do with it, which gave me the ability to have compassion for others. I was raised in the San Francisco Bay Area by a really, really loving mother who worked two jobs to support me, who focused on education, who said, as a woman, you need to have a secure job so that no man will ever control you. You'll never be dependent on him, and that you will always be able to have control of your own destination, of where you work, how you live. So I worked super hard in school. My mom raised me to be really focused on school. I was a bit of a nerd, and I had to work hard. I mean, I'm smart, but I'm not one of those really smart people. So I had to work really hard to get decent grades.
What's really smart? Because I think anybody would say, if you're a law professor at the University of California, you must be pretty smart.
I am an expert at this point. I've been a lawyer for 20 years, so I'm an expert in my field through a lot of hard work and some chances. I do think that everyone has the capacity to become whatever sort of profession they want. I know, though, that life has a lot of barriers, and some of them are societal, sort of social, cultural, economic discrimination. I get all that. But in terms of the human person, I think that we all have the capacity. So I'm just another person who has that capacity.
So you're seriously telling me that I could have become, if I really wanted to, a law professor and work at the university, the Foundation of Aristide in Port-au-Prince. Little me, who's a functioning dyslexic.
Without a doubt, I don't even hesitate or need to think about that. You absolutely could have and probably still could.
So you're seriously telling me that then professors and law professors don't have to be that bright then, if I can do it.
I think you're probably underestimating your intelligence.
Okay, I don't think I am, but anyway. So you grew up with a single mum. She instilled in you great values of self-reliance, of independence. Tell me about those early years when you finished university. I want to understand that jump from then, the late 90s, early 2000s, to Haiti.
So I think that when one decides to do international human rights or social justice work, it can be domestically, it can be international, it's all the same. It's a drive that you have inside of you that motivates you to only do sort of service work for others. And that is, it's a bug that sort of bites you. It's a fire in the belly that happens. And what is that moment in which that happens? And I think for me, you know, there were several of them, but one that I can remember is when I was in college and I was reading a book called Don't Be Afraid, Gringo, which is a woman, a campesina worker in Honduras who was doing land rights. And she talked about the usefulness of foreign lawyers, in particular from the United States, coming in and helping her with the land struggle. And it was sort of at that, I was living in Mexico at the time, and it was at that moment where I got that fire in my belly and I said, yes, this is it. The excitement that I have for this work that she's doing, any job that I have must mirror it. And so when I graduated from law school, became a union labor lawyer. I worked for a law firm that represented unions, and I did that for about 10 years, became a partner in that law firm. And I resigned as a partner in the law firm. I actually sort of turned down the partnership and decided that I wanted to focus more on international human rights work. And so at that moment, the law school where I had gone, University of San Francisco, the dean offered me a position with them to oversee a research project with an organization in Haiti. And I barely knew where Haiti was, to be honest. I didn't know that it shared the island with the Dominican Republic. I didn't know its history, but I spoke French and I was interested in international human rights and I had some background in it. And so I said yes, and that sort of started this course of, I worked with the law school for about 4 years and decided that I wanted to do work for that organization that I was working with.
Were you giving up anything in the US? And I think you said also at the time you were also down in Mexico. Were you consciously giving up anything, not only just to dedicate your energies to Haiti, but also to potentially to go and live there?
Well, sure. I mean, when I was a partner in a law firm, I had, we were still workers' rights, so we weren't, you know, comparatively to other corporate lawyers, huge salaries, but it was a very, very comfortable living and mm-hmm. security. So I gave up all of that. I had a nice travel budget. You know, I gave up health benefits. When I did the move to start working in Haiti full time, I had no salary for almost a year and then had half salary. Anyway, so certainly there was a financial cut, which I think happens to anyone who does this work. There also is the unknown. I think I was about 38 or so when I decided to live in Haiti, and that's a pretty big change for somebody who's, for really any age, but just certainly at 38, you have certain standards of living that you're used to. So when I moved there, our apartment most of the time didn't have electricity, often didn't have running water, had mice, had cockroaches. There were sort of part of it. And what was the most challenging was it was right after the earthquake of January 2010 when I started living there. And there were about over a million people were displaced by the earthquake. And so we had displacement camps, sort of what we would think of as refugee camps, but they were internal displacement of homeless people living all mm-hmm. around and so desperate for money. And so that was also the biggest shift what I needed to get used to was living in constant face to face with poverty and desperation.
Why is Haiti so poor in your opinion? I think we all have an opinion that we only ever hear about Haiti when something goes wrong, and invariably it's an earthquake or some kind of natural disaster. And then we see these images of Port-au-Prince, and it feels not even like Africa. It feels like Africa of our, the Africa of our past. We're not talking about images of Nairobi with its shopping malls and gated communities, or even thrusting Lagos. This is the Africa of our prejudice. Why is Haiti, in your opinion, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere?
Well, this is certainly a complicated question, but an important one, and it's a complicated answer. I think it started back when Haiti was the first slave revolt that ended in the first independent Black nation in the world in 1804. This was about 60 years, at least three generations before slavery was considered illegal under the Emancipation Proclamation by President Lincoln in the United States. So for 60 years, Haiti had abolished slavery, was independent from the French, and was a threat to all slave-owning countries that existed in the rest of the world. And so as a result, they were punished by the United States, France, Britain, Canada, who promised to attack them and sort of reoccupy them at any point. They levied a significant debt of, that was at the time, 150 million francs, which today, with interest paid, is about 21 billion dollars. And this debt that they levied on Haiti starting in the 1820s was for their lost chattel, their lost property, which most of which was slaves. So France made Haiti pay for their freedom of humans. And so this debt wasn't paid off until the 1940s at exorbitant interest rates. That meant that as Haiti was developing in the 19th and 20th century, that they were spending more than they were earning. There also was embargoes, trade embargoes. Haiti was the jewel of the Caribbean, the second wealthiest colony in the New World right after the United States. And so as soon as there was an embargo against them, because they had the audacity to declare freedom against slavery, the embargo crippled their economy, and as did the repayments of this loan. So they never were able to make the investments in public infrastructures like schools and public buildings that the rest of the world was able to make. If you fast forward then into the 20th century, when the United States did this sort of new imperialism and started taking over colonies like Puerto Rico, they tried Cuba, all over, they tried Haiti and actually occupied Haiti for about 15 years. They stole a lot of the reserves of gold in Haiti's bank and tried to own all of its land. And then fast forward to the dictatorship of 30 years, the Duvaliers, Papa Doc and Baby Doc, François and Jean-Claude Duvalier. And in that time, the United States was propping up these dictators and paying them, giving them funds to operate their business that killed tens of thousands of people in one of the worst dictatorships of the 20th century. Why did we do that? Because there was a Cold War and we wanted to control them. So this legacy of interference by the international community has left a country that has a very weak and corrupt political system, economy that's almost non-existent. It's operated as sort of this kleptocracy and instability. And that is what causes the poverty. When you look at the earthquake of January 2010, It was the same earthquake that I survived in magnitude of a 7.0 that I survived in San Francisco in 1989 that killed a few hundred people. And in Haiti, it killed over 200,000 people. So it's not Mother Nature that's killing people in Haiti. It's the poverty and it's the lack of government structure.
Take us back to 2010, I think it was, when you've not only decided that you need to do human rights law, but you've decided to go to Haiti. Tell us about that first day, that first week, those first impressions of being in somewhere which is extremely different from your native Bay Area.
Well, when I first arrived in Haiti around May 1st of 2010, so it was a couple months after the earthquake, the city of Port-au-Prince had piles of rubble everywhere. You couldn't pass very easily on roads. There still were close to a million people living in the streets under tarps and tents. The population of Port-au-Prince is 3 million, so it's about a third of its people. People were afraid to sleep in structures. They were afraid of other earthquakes. They were afraid that the buildings were going to fall. They didn't quite understand what had happened with the earthquake. Nobody had remembered ever experiencing an earthquake before. And so it was a state of confusion and desperation. The internal displacement camps where people were living, which were everywhere around the city, were dangerous. They didn't have clean water. They didn't have bathrooms where people could go. The aid community that came by the hundreds to assist people, the doctors had done a wonderful job in the aftermath of helping people. But the lingering giving of food, etc., people were not receiving the assistance that they needed and were complaining. So when I arrived there, I was working at a public interest law firm called the Bureau des Avocats Nationaux, International Lawyers Office. We had a displacement camp that was really close. Well, it was everywhere, but there was a huge one of 30,000 people close to us. And we had grassroots partners that we worked with for years. And most of their leaders, particularly the women's organizations, were living in these camps, were complaining of conditions and of sexual assaults that were happening daily in the camps. So when I arrived, this is the scene I arrived to. The hotels weren't really open yet. So I was sleeping in a tent in our parking lot on concrete of our law firm. And by 6 a.m., people were lining up to talk to us, to talk to me as a foreigner, hoping that I'd be able to help them. And of course, I'm just a lawyer with a laptop that didn't even have access to the internet. There wasn't a lot I could do about the humanitarian situation. So a lot of that time was spent listening. The project that I was sent there down to do was that forced evictions were happening in the displacement camps. People were getting sick of people living on their school sites, in the middle of highways, on medians, on private land. They wanted their land back. And so they were using violence in order to scare, terrorize, and evict people. So that I was meeting with people that had lost family members, were being terrorized in the evenings in order to leave their camps, and trying to figure out a strategy, a national, international campaign to stop these evictions and also to force the government to relocate people into safer areas. I guess the only thing anything else I'll add was that when I got back from this trip, I went and saw a doctor, and she said that my body was still in shock. She said that the way my nervous system was running in my body, that I, you know, a few days after I'd gotten back from my 2 weeks in Haiti from this initial visit, that I was in a state of shock.
So you started working for the Institute of Justice and Democracy in Haiti. But how difficult is it to shake the impression that you're just not just another gringo, you know, somebody coming to help the poor benighted Haitians?
Well, of course, it's always possible that we're blinded by our ego. So I may, in fact, be that gringo. But I listen to my Haitian colleagues and sort of try and take direction from them. And I do the best I can to assure that I'm doing the best work that I can. One of the most organic feeling positions that I have is as a law professor in Haiti. That seems, you know, law schools around the country of the United States, and I'm sure around the world, have visiting professors from other countries. I think that the exchange of ideas and different concepts and stuff is always important. So that feels like a really good fit. When I was working at the law firm, the BAI, our managing partner, Mario Joseph, was really, really difficult to work with at times, but also very good about pushing back on foreigners and our natural proclivities for wanting things to get done as quickly as possible and in sort of the way that we've been taught. And he pushed back against it and gave me an amazing education on how I can tread lightly and support people without imposing my own education and ideas of how things should be, to really listen. And so I feel very lucky to have worked with him for so long and to really have that level of awareness. Sort of all I, you know, what I try and aspire to is constantly aware of what is my presence, how is this changing the dynamic in the relationship, and to try and support lawyers, but also have them request to me what it is they think they want me to do, how I can be helpful, as opposed to me coming up with the ideas and saying, this is what I think I should do, and spending my money where I want it, where I think it should go. I wait until people ask me what they think, where I can help and what I can do. And quite frankly, most of my work in Haiti over those 8 years was leading international campaigns. So Haitian lawyers, they do all of the arguing in Haitian court. That's not for me to do. But what I do is when the U.S. Congress issues terrible policies in Haiti, when USAID is wreaking havoc without accountability, when the United Nations or the Organization of American States, when they have policy decisions that they can make, then I would be leading those campaigns and trying to educate the international community.
You've been in Haiti for 8 years. You've obviously grown not only to know it, but to love it. Let's deal with the professional first, and then let's go on to the personal. Give us two accomplishments which you're most proud of in your time being in Haiti.
Well, one is that there was a displacement camp. Back to that project that I was working with, was trying to stop forced evictions. There was a displacement camp called Grace Village that was named after a Haitian minister that was being supported from money from churches around the United States. And he had one of the worst displacement camps that I visited. It was, it had sort of fences all around it. He wasn't allowing aid to come into the camp. And the people within, there was thousands of people living there. You know, half of the people living there were children. And there were rocks and things thrown at nighttime to terrify the people, to try and scare them to leave. In the meantime, though, to the congregations in the United States that he would visit and ask for money, he talked about what a saint he was for helping people affected by the earthquake. So the contradiction there, the hypocrisy, was abhorrent. And so the community organized, and we filed a lawsuit with the Inter-American Commission Human Rights, which is a body of the Organization of American States, the human rights accountability arm of that, that Haiti is a member, as is the United States. And we said that these forced evictions needed to stop and that people needed to be relocated in safe places. And we won. We also did a bit of a campaign against the pastor. But we won, and the evictions did stop. And with the assistance of the government and the USAID project, the people were given money and were relocated to safer places. It wasn't ideal. If I had been drafting the plan, they would have been a lot, you know, they would have had a lot more money. And, but I think it was a good, I think that was a good solution for those people. And it really came out of their hard work. They were so well spoken and so patient with journalists and members of the international community coming out that it allowed us to have the lawyers to sort of come in and do their work and get this victory for them. Another victory would be the case of the prosecution of Jean-Claude Duvalier, who, along with his father, was a dictator. He and his father ruled Haiti for about 30 years. And he himself took office at the age of 19 when his father died, and he went into exile in France in 1986. He came back to Haiti in 2011, and our office assisted in arresting him, filing criminal complaints, and in prosecuting him. The president at the time, Michel Martelly, was a Duvalier, meaning his support came from Duvalier supporters. So he fired prosecutors, fired judges in order to make sure that this guy was not prosecuted. But we were bigger than him, and we were able to get this case before the appellate court. The appellate court summoned him and forced him to testify before. Of course, it was televised by international and national media. We summoned people from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the BBC. It was covered by everyone. And, you know, I was tweeting from the courtroom, et cetera. And the appellate court overturned, used international legal arguments that our partners provided the American court in an amicus brief, which to my knowledge has never actually been submitted in Haiti before. But we submitted an amicus brief signed on by, I think it was around 20 or so international organizations and law schools from around the world. And the appellate court reinstated the case against Jean-Claude Duvalier and remanded it to the trial court to be prosecuted. And so that was a really exciting victory. Jean-Claude Duvalier died shortly afterwards, so there never was a trial against him. But the fact that he was forced to go to the court and testify was through a packed courtroom was really a victorious moment.
It occurred to me that what I've done is to reduce Haiti to the Haiti of our dystopian dreams. What are Haitian people like? I didn't ask you about the people, I asked you about the place. Because you've obviously fallen in love not just with the work, but with the people. So tell us about Haitian people.
Well, of course, it's hard to generalize, right? And I'm a foreigner.
It's easy. It's easy. Come on, this is a glib interview on a podcast. No, I know it's not easy. But there must be general characteristics of the people that you've come to know and love. That, you know, you're not anywhere for 8 years purely for professional reasons. You develop a love for the culture, the food, the religions, the smells, the sights, and that's what I really want to pivot to on the next part of our interview, because I know that you married not one, not two, not three, not even four, but five Haitian spirits. And that doesn't come from just being a human rights activist. That's because that's somebody who loves and embraces the culture. So we need to understand that.
Right. Well, so take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. This is just my perspective. So my perspective is that Haitian people that I've sort of interacted with at the levels that I've interacted with them One of the things that I respect, there's two things that I respect the most about them, or maybe even three things. One is their resistance, that fervor that, imagine being enslaved for 300 years with absolutely no hope. It's all you've ever known. It's all your ancestors have ever known. I've been under the Trump administration now for 2 years, and I can't imagine how we're possibly going to get out from underneath this. Imagine 300 years of slavery and having the courage to rise up and do what no other slave nation has ever done and beat down your oppressors. And of course, they were assisted with Haitian spirits, but we'll get to that later. That resistance, that unwillingness to accept the inequality and the violence is what is still within the Haitian people today. It's interesting, there's a nationalism, and people can have big conflicts over President Aristide or various different political issues. But in the end of the day, they all are resistant to international imperialism, all of them, whether you're from the right or from you're from the left. You may be profiting from it, but you're sort of doing it despite them in order to benefit yourself, but you are against it. You're raging against the machine. And that made it for me so inspiring to live there and difficult to live there because, of course, your listeners don't know, but I'm white. And so I stand out. And in the communities where I hang out in, I'm often the only white person in the room. And so I would imagine with this resistance that there would be sort of this immediate antagonism against me. And to my surprise, the second thing that I love so much about Haitians is that they're also just fair. They judged me based on me. Did I speak the language Haitian Creole? Okay, then I'm okay. How did I view myself? Was I willing? Was I smiling to them? Was I open? Did I know about Haiti? Did I act? And they really judged me based on me. And once most people, once they sort of spoke to me and realized the work that I was doing there and sort of how I lived, were so welcoming. I mean, beyond welcoming. Obviously, I had, for a population that is so, where jobs are so scarce, it was clear that I was gainfully employed in their country. And crime almost never happened to me. People, I just was surprised at how safe I felt among people and that people protected me and watched over me as if I was one of them. I sort of felt like, the animal videos where it's like the mother cat takes in a squirrel. And I felt like a squirrel that was able to feed on the mom cat, just like her other kittens. I've never felt such community and love and safe, ironically, safeness when you're in a crowd of people that are looking after each other. I mean, Haitians don't have the police. They don't have the state to protect them. They protect each other based on their community, their families, their neighbors, who they know. And when you're part of that, which of course, I was never 100%, I wasn't 100% part of that. It's not my birth parent, but I was certainly accepted. And it's a pretty amazing feeling. And I think the other thing is just this sense of joy, which people have. When I would go into these displacement camps after the earthquake that smelled awful, stories were awful, they were hot, people didn't have water and food. I mean, it's just sort of the worst conditions that humanity can face. By 5 p.m., there still was, the music started, kids started dancing. There still was a joie de vivre, right? Like a joy that was circulating that most people were able to feel, if only for moments of the time. And that's the resilience that people talk about with Haitians. And it really is beautiful. And I guess there's so many things, but I guess the last thing is just this wisdom that Haitians have. There's just, in order to not have a stable economy and to not have a government that will protect you, imagine making a living and figuring out the system and feeding your family, and people that do that day in and day out with all the uncertainties and the cards stacked against you. It's an incredible intelligence and wisdom that people have, that I learn from all the time, and I'm just amazed by every single day.
We don't know, in the West, in whether it's in America or Britain, too many famous Haitians, but there is one, Wyclef Jean, who was big some time ago, but his name still has somewhat of an echo, a resonance. He ran to be president, or at least he wanted to become president. And I was vaguely aware of this when you picked this as your piece of music. Tell us about Wyclef Jean's run to try and become Haitian president, and also then end up by telling us why you decided to choose this piece of music as your music on today's show.
I've respected Wyclef Jean and absolutely loved him when he was with the Fugees. I'm not very music savvy, so I had not followed his career after the Fugees. But when I got to Haiti, I had heard that he was hoping to put his name in the hat to run for president. This was in 2010. The elections, the first set of elections were in November, and the earthquake had been in January earlier that year. So it's right afterwards. And he had a nonprofit organization that was doing humanitarian work. I would sometimes see him and or people wearing T-shirts with the name of his organization operating in displacement camps. And people hadn't heard of him that much in Haiti, a little bit, but his music had largely been in English. And so I think a lot of Haitian youth weren't really familiar with it, but he was starting to make a name for himself. He was excluded by the Electoral Council to run for elections. And the reason was because there's a provision in the Constitution that states that you had to have lived, you can't be a citizen of another country. You can only be a citizen of Haiti. And you had to have lived the last 5 years in Haiti. And he clearly had not, at least based on the evidence that I saw. And so he was disqualified. But he did not take that well, and he made a big scene around it and said that it was unfair for him to be disqualified, etc. So I was writing an op-ed at the time. I forgot where it went. It might have gone to the Miami Herald. That was a commentary on the elections and sort of the U.S. government's heavy, unfair hand in the elections. And I was thinking about the disqualification of Wyclef, which in my legal opinion was correct, one of the few things that the Electoral Council got right. And so I was listening to a song that Wyclef had put together sort of seemingly overnight about his disqualification, the unfairness in the elections. And I was angry at sort of the corruption within the Haitian government and him. And then I listened to the song and was reminded about how damn talented this man was. And I instantly loved this song. And I think it represents Haiti really well, because there are so many complicated issues within Haiti where you love something and hate something all at the same time. So this is a song I recommended for you, which it sounds like he has translated it into English and put it into a lovely video.
My generation like
we okay. As long as we got music, we gon' dance all day. He gon' vote Taylor Swift, she gon' vote Kanye. Yeah. Election time is coming.
Come on.
We okay. As long as we got music, we gon' party all day. She gon' vote you too, he gon' vote Coldplay.
Immigration, socialism, capitalism, racism, healthcare, welfare, seems like nobody cares. Big business, corporations, small business, taxation, unemployment, education, my generation. Build the space station, so when you go to Earth, you can see all the Haitians as they rebuild their nation. With fair trade, everybody trade, you trade, I trade, and everybody get paid. Elections, I'm around the corner, who you gon' vote for? Time around the corner, what you gon' fight for?
We okay.
Election time around the corner.
wondering, do you want peace or war?
Alternative energy or oil in your SUV. Tell me what you're looking for. We about to have a poll. Gun control, infrastructure, agriculture, manufacturing. Hip-hop, be my culture. Tell me what you think about it. Technology and foreign policy. I need to bail out money to stimulate the economy. Raise on family values. My life be my testament. King had a dream and you too can be the president.
Elections, I'm around the corner. Who you gonna vote for? Elections, I'm around the corner. What you gonna fight for?
We vote him.
Elections, I'm around the corner. Who you gonna vote for?
We vote him.
Election time is coming. Do you want peace or war?
But the kids like,
we okay. As long as we got music, we gon' dance all day. He gon' vote Taylor Swift, she gon' vote Kanye. Yeah, election time is coming.
But the kids like,
we okay. As long as we got music, we gon' party all day. She gon' vote you too, he gon' vote Coldplay.
Yeah, play, play, I know election
play,
time,
election
almost
time
serious,
is coming.
Right? You know what?
What?
Why don't you kick some of that stuff I grew up on? You know what I'm talking about? I got you, yeah. Gramps was a voodoo priest. Dad was a preacher. Uncle was a mason. I was raised Christian. Best friend was Slim. Al-Salam alaikum. My manager was Jewish. He taught me Shabbat Shalom. Flatbush Rastas. Taught me the scriptures. Haile Selassie. Marcus Garvey. St. Louvre. Haitian Revolution. Napoleon's army got spanked by them Haitians. Tucson, St. John with the info. Did you know that a Haitian founded Chicago? If I was president, the first thing I would do is get my people out the tents.
Election time is coming.
My generation like
we okay. As long as we got music, we gon' dance all day. He gon' vote Taylor Swift, she gon' vote Kanye. Yeah, yeah. Election time is coming.
But the kids like
we okay. As long as we got music, we gon' party all day. She gon' vote you.
In your last answer, you mentioned a very Haitian trait of hating something and loving something in the equal measure. How many times do you fall in love in Haiti?
Oh, every day, multiple times a day. With smiles, people's smiles, I fall in love with people's smiles. Every day.
Haitian smile, I get the sense, definitely from you, that they're the, you know, that joy of life. You mentioned that before. How easy is it when you are foreign, you are different, to romantically embrace yourself into a culture which, at least on the face of it, is going to seem so different, so much poorer in material terms, not in spiritual terms, than the one that you know? Are you, as an expat lawyer, an expat professional, primarily hanging out with people like yourself, that people who are maybe American, or maybe other lawyers from around the world. How does the socialization work before you fall in love with a Haitian and their smile?
It's funny, this reminds me of, I think it could be Kourjif, but I think it's a Rumi poem that talks about, we think that we're waiting for God to speak to us, and it's actually God that's waiting for us to speak to her. And I think that sort of summarizes what it's like, was like for me to be a foreigner in Haiti. I felt separate. I felt different. I didn't speak Creole when I first got there. I spoke French, but most people understand some French, but really feel comfortable in Creole. And some don't even understand French at all. And so I just felt so different. And when it's piece by piece. I mean, it took me many, many, many years to sort of get through this on my own, which is my own ego issues. When I first sort of realized that I wasn't separate and started to integrate more, I realized how open and welcoming and wonderful, and that all that separation had been my own head, not in Haitians' heads themselves. A little bit. There's a little bit of that, but in general, people are so open and warm and welcoming and excited to get to know you. And of course, there's going to be some awkward cultural issues, but then you just, they get over that in us and we get over that in them. And that's what the joy is. That's where you learn about it. There is, of course, a huge community of expats. I think a lot of the humanitarian workers in particular that came to Haiti after the earthquake had been to maybe 2 or 3 or 12 countries before that. They maybe didn't speak Creole or didn't speak it very well. They may not even have spoken French, so they weren't able to communicate with Haitians. There was, especially in that time, so much misery on the streets that it's easy for people to just sort of want to turn your head, not to be able to be ensconced in it 24/7. You know, we live in our own expat housing situations where the standards are probably going to be higher than what most Haitians live in, although certainly there is a wealthy sector within Haiti, you know, of Haitians themselves, the bourgeoisie. But of course, when you go into restaurants, we call them the blanc restaurants. Blanc is what you describe as like gringo or foreigner, but it technically means white people. And so, yeah, there's where blanc hang out. And a lot of Haitians will see that, oh, that's where the blanc hang out, and kind of generalize us because of that, understandably. And I think it's up to us, you know, we can live that way. And I think a lot of people live happily that way. But there's other options, right? There's options of integrating more in. And there's a lot of people that feel comfortable and integrate more with the bourgeoisie, going to the clubs and restaurants and stuff that the bourgeois go to, which can be fun. I've certainly done that. And then there's also integrating. For me, it was through dance classes. I took dance classes and went dancing, like what they call it, Latin dance, like salsa and stuff. And then that will give you just access to, you know, middle class. It was through my work. I worked with all Haitians. Often I was the only foreigner in the office. So that was a great way to integrate. I also had a boyfriend and his family and his community, and that allowed me to integrate as well as sort of within the voodoo community there.
So which came first, the boyfriend or the love of Haitian voodoo?
The boyfriend.
Tell us about the boyfriend. What did he do? How did you meet?
We met on the dance floor. He's, in my opinion, he's Haiti's best salsa dancer. And I've danced with a lot of people, and he's extraordinary. So we met on the dance floor and he became my dance teacher, and things sort of happened from there romantically.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Any peculiarities, anything which you found as being different about maybe having a romantic relationship in Haiti? Because I've not traveled to a culture wildly dissimilar from my own host one. So I'm English, I'm a Brummie, I'm from Birmingham, sorry. Then I've dated in London and then some in San Francisco. And within these fundamentally very similar cultures, there are nuanced differences, but the nuanced differences, you know, I can go from one country to another, and it fundamentally looks like dating that I know and recognize. Are there any differences between, you know, being in a romantic relationship in Haiti for somebody who was born in San Francisco?
Yeah, and well, certainly my experience dating in Haiti is going to be different than the experience of a Haitian woman.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the
things... Is that because you're foreign or because you're white?
All of the above. It's going to be because I'm foreign, because I'm white, and I'm perceived to have resources to be wealthier, and probably because of education levels as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a really interesting anthropological story book that I read talks about in sort of the poorer areas, sort of peasant areas, or urban poor even areas of Haiti, that relationships are based a little bit on love, maybe sort of that spark and that love or lust at the beginning, but mostly it's a business relationship based on the financials, based on economics. It's based on, does the woman calculate that she is going to be able, that he will help her survive economically? Is it a good idea to have a baby with him? Will he give her money for that? Will he be able to support the family? She needs to leave her family because they can't afford her anymore. She can't get work. And so she's looking to a man to support her and her babies. It's common to have babies with more than one man. It's common for the man to not stick around, for him to have more than one woman at the same time. So this is sort of the backdrop. I lived there for many years without having a relationship in Haiti, in part because at various times I had relationships sort of back in the States that were long distance, but also because it seemed really complicated and I wanted to make sure that I was able to do it as ethically as possible, knowing that it just really had to be a relationship of equality. And so when I had met my boyfriend at the time, it really felt like a relationship of equality because he was a dance teacher and I was a dance student. But he was also a law student and I was a law professor. He was very educated. He was extremely intelligent. And so it felt in my eyes like an equal relationship. Our economics, however, were different. And to me, that didn't matter. But I think as a foreigner operating there, it had tremendous consequences. Not just for him. I mean, if he's able to put that aside, it has enormous consequences for our community. He would talk all the time about how anytime he would see one of his friends, they often would ask, how's your blanc? How's your white lady? Basically, how is she? And then they would start to ask him for money because he was dating me. They would see him differently. We had to choose where we would want to live. We couldn't live in sort of his more popular neighborhood, because I would be the only foreigner living there, and that could produce safety issues for him, his family, and for me as well. And it's tremendous to get over these. Even if I get over this, for him to have to get over feeling like he's sort of a kept man. Haitian men, it's a very machismo culture, like the rest of sort of Latin America and the Caribbean. And so there were awkward moments within that made it a very difficult relationship in many ways. And it also made, when you overcome that, when you transcend that, it's absolute freedom and amazing. So there are equal, you know, beautiful moments as well. So there were a lot of difficulties with the relationship because of sort of those cultural barriers. But also there were just as many wonderful moments, because when you transcend the cultural, societal, economic differences and you just see two people who love each other and you just see that and you can work beyond it, it's truly magic. I mean, we also had some truly...
So you're in a relationship, not without its problems, but all relationships have them. And then you decide that you need to immerse yourself further into Haitian culture by taking on Haitian voodoo. and in April you married five Haitian spirits. What led you to April?
Well, one of the things that is also common in Haitian relationships is that men will have more than one partner. So he will have a primary partner. He might be married to her, he might not. And then he'll often have a girlfriend and often even what they call tizami, like sort of lovers from that. That was a structure that wasn't working for me. And so I was asking him about this. I was sort of realizing this months and months into the relationship and asking him about this. And he knew that if he came on, if he was honest with me, that there was a good chance I was going to leave him. And so he was lying about it. So our relationship sort of disintegrated into this difficult moment. And we had been practicing voodoo together. He sort of came to it when I came to it as well. When you don't have a state that can intervene, when you don't have a justice system that is very strong, when terrible things happen to you, or even when medical issues happen to you and there aren't very good doctors available that you can afford, you turn, when you're in Haiti, you often turn to voodoo priests and priestesses. So in this case, we had been victims of violence, of threat. And so our car, he was hijacked, driving our car, carjacked, and had a gun pointed to him and was absolutely terrified. So we went to a Haitian priest together. They called an Ugan. A male is called an Ugan, a female is called a Mambo. So we went to an Ugan and started getting into voodoo that way. So it was sort of at the same time. Fast forward a few months, and as this relationship was disintegrating and I was trying to leave him, I was asking lots of questions about the relationship, and I reached out to a Mambo, a Haitian priestess, on my own. And she revealed to me that in order to keep me, that my boyfriend was using voodoo magic against me, and that his girlfriend, this was the first time I was able to confirm that he actually had a girlfriend, she wanted to destroy me. So she was using voodoo magic against me as well. And that this was explaining why I had lost a considerable amount of weight. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was crying every day. It was sort of in the Mambo's mind, what was explaining all of this.
Some people are going to be somewhat skeptical about voodoo, seen as magic or hocus pocus. And it's purely, and they might say, well, okay, it wasn't that. She was deploying any real voodoo against you. It was quite simply, you were worried about the relationship, maybe, and you were stressing about that, or maybe you had some other ailment or malady. Tell us and explain why these skeptics might be wrong, why Haitian magic is real.
Well, I have a lawyer analytical brain, and I'm not somebody who's ever had, seen ghosts or whatever it is. You know, there are those people that we all know that have these mystical experiences all the time. And that hasn't been me. So I didn't even search out voodoo free. I was fascinated by it, but I was like, no, you got to get an invitation. Like, you can't just, you've got to be invited to this. So I think one of the first things is that I think I was probably called to it when I was. And so when I first started going to ceremonies and I would see maybe a relative, the brother of my boyfriend at the time or others, the practice of the religion is in ceremonies, a spirit, what they call mount, the head, will possess the human, for example, my old boyfriend's brother. And then it's no longer the brother that's speaking, it's the spirit that's speaking through the human and speaking to us and giving us prescription of what we should do and explaining things and telling us to do particular practices and stuff. And I was very skeptical when I first, you know, I didn't trust anybody. And I didn't understand the religion at all. And I hadn't read anything about it. All the transmission was oral. And so it was eventually when I saw enough of this possession of spirits to humans, when I realized there's no way that these people are all acting. There's just no way. And so it was in that moment where you have to first make the first assumption and say, okay, this is real. And then when you look out to other indigenous cultures, because the spirits, Haitian spirits, come from the motherland. They come from what's now Benin and Nigeria, and different places. And also from the indigenous culture, the Tainos that lived in Haiti before Haitians got there. That's where the spirits are coming from. So this is an indigenous, largely an indigenous religion, and that when you look to other indigenous religions, the spirit possession and relationship with spirits is quite common. So once I got to understand that it was sort of me who had the problem that didn't believe in this, and that this was actually a thing that I just hadn't been exposed to in my little primitive life in San Francisco, then it opened up a whole world to me.
It's opened up a whole world to you. And it's a world which you're currently away from at the moment. So you're in San Francisco at the moment. When will you be back in Haiti?
In July. Although the spirit world, you're never away from. The spirits are with you wherever you are. But I will. Certainly, I do feel them more strongly when I'm in Haiti. And I feel more in flow with them. And I will be back in July.
And just before you finish up, because you've just alluded to the fact that you do take your love and immersion and understanding of Haitian religions, with Haitian religion, I should say, singular, with you when you come back in the Bay Area. So how do you manage to keep up with your religion's observance whilst you're back home?
So I seek out anybody else who's a voodoo practitioner. And my Haitian folklore dance teacher is a mambo. She's a Haitian priestess. And then there's a drummer that drums for our classes. And he's a Haitian Ugan. So he's also a priest. So part of its community, which is similar to Buddhism or Hinduism, which is Sangha or Satsang, that's really important. So I've got that as much as I can. I have an altar in my home that, that has representations and for the spirits. I also observe I have wedding rings from my marriage. So there's a ring that represents the spirits that I've married that I wear all the time. And then there are certain days where you observe the spirits, and that's my way of sort of serving and honoring the spirits.
Nicole Phillips, thank you for coming on to Friday and explaining how a woman from a single parent family in the Bay Area can end up being immersed, loving, appreciating, and doing good in Haiti.
Thank you. This has really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.